that if a person has any type of a false idea of God, so then he doesn't have belief in God. He does not believe. So they say the person's not a mammon. So then you have to consider him as though he had no. In other words, as though he has no belief in God. In fact, he might even be worse than a person who has no belief in God, because he has a false idea of God. Now I'm not, you know, saying anything about that at this point. But the entire world wouldn't look at it that way. They would say that a person believes in God, he's a believer. And all right, whatever his notion is, within reason, of course, it's not too crazy, so then it's probably a good thing. This is contrary to what the Rambam is saying. He's saying he has no belief in God. Because God is just a word. And if you associate with that word, you associate something which is not in reality, which is not in existence, so then you're not relating to a being that's in existence. So that's not belief. Okay? That's where we started. There's a tremendous irony over here, and that the modern from world has become so preoccupied, ostensibly in terms of being Jewish, with things that are either not that important in the system, but have some importance, or things which are totally extraneous, like what kind of hat do you wear on Shabbos, and what kind of hat do you wear during the week, you know, like things, and or they become extremely machmir about areas where you don't have to be machmir or that machmir, but the area which is the most important of all. And that is to say, the elimination of Avodah Zarah, because it's only through the elimination of Avodah Zarah that one can have any kind of a relationship to God. Now, in Yahadis, the elimination of Avodah Zarah is the whole foundation, because man by nature is an Oved Avodah Zarah. He's an idolatrous being. He's religious by nature, and what he has to do is to transform, take the energy from his nature, the religious nature, and to work out a relationship to God which is correct, which is based upon reality, to the extent that he can have it. Now, there's an area where we should be machmir. There's an area where people, just the opposite, where they encourage any person, you know, all of this emotional energy and enthusiasm, which might be producing false ideas, you know, in terms of davening and so on and so forth. This is the area where there's absolutely no desire to be really machmir. Here they're makel, as I said, with regard to certain practices that may be borderline avodah zarah, you know, stuff like that. There's no desire to be machmir at all. That's something that's extremely important. That's why you should read this very, very slowly, very carefully. It's not that simple to understand. But it's important that you gain some understanding of it. Now, but then another question came up. The question that's being asked is, if we come up with an idea which makes absolute sense to us, and yet the implications would be, if that idea were true, that the majority of people, religious people as we know them, are completely in error, seriously in error, so should that have any effect on us? Should we perhaps go back to the drawing board and maybe we've made a mistake? Now, the Rambam talks about Avraham Avinu, because he found himself, I would say, in a similar situation. Because according to the Rambam, he was the only one. The entire world was steeped in idolatry, except for a few individuals. He himself didn't have any teacher. Let's see if we can analyze step by step. It's beautiful, the description the Rambam gives of the history, so to speak, of Avraham Avinu. He says, after many, many years, he said he began this process of investigation when he was 3 years old. It took him a long time because he was raised in that society, so he didn't just abandon. He practiced idolatry together with them, but at the same time his mind was working. It's a beautiful description of what's going on. You know, he's living in the false society, and he's practicing, he's going along with them. At the same time, his mind is thinking, he's analyzing. By the way, that really that's another important story over there, is that it shows you the power of the field. Because a lot of people, this bothers a lot of people. That what, in fact, this guy, like John Lennon, goes this way, you know, what about the fact that the majority of the world doesn't have the truth? And nobody, and that's always a ministry thing. There's no outreach. The Jews aren't reaching out to try and save the Gentiles. Well, the answer to that is that the opportunity is there. It really is supposed to be the plan of God once the Jewish people has been established, is that we should not go out and proselytize, but that the nation should be attracted to us. That's the real answer to that question. That's the design of the system. That's what it says in the Varm, that the nations will see. They'll say Rakam Chacham V'Navam. So it means to say that there are two ways that people can be brought to the truth. One is that we go after them and try and teach them. That's not the method that has been chosen. The method that has been chosen is that God set up people that would be like a beacon of light, so to speak. That would be completely different. I'm Kadosh, it would be totally different. And once, you know, you find a nation which would be successful in all its ways, and that would be so compelling that it would attract those who are interested from the other nations. The paradigm of that is the case of Yisrael. Yishma Yisrael, he heard and he came to investigate. Okay? But this doesn't exist in our time. That's a failure of the Jewish people to fulfill its mission vis-a-vis mankind. Part of our corruption, you see, Jews don't want to look at it this way. Jews blame everybody else for their own problem. Anti-Semitism, that's the end of that. And that's, you know, the simplistic notion. Jews are superior. Gentiles are inferior. Therefore, Gentiles hate us. They put us down, you know, and so on and so forth. If they came to their senses, they would see that we have the correct religion. But there are some Gentiles that do arrive at that notion, but that's because they study the sources, not because they observe Jews. Well, it's because there are Gentiles that have been taught, you know, they've been steeped in the Old Testament, New Testament, and they use their minds, they start the question, and you know, they resist the false teachings, and eventually they do come around to discovering the truth. But that's not because they've seen that the Jews are so different that they're superior. Now, but the case of Avram shows you the koach of free will, that a person steeped in a false society, like Avram Avinu, still has the ability to use his mind. But if he wants to use his mind, if he wants to question, then he'll be able to free himself. He'll be able to free himself and arrive at the truth. That's certainly true today. I mean, the time that we're in today is much, much more conducive to that than the time of Avraham Avinu, when there was absolutely nobody. He had no communication. Today, there is a Jewish people, there's the books are available, there's the internet. I mean, no, I'm serious. A person that's genuinely interested in finding out, there's no excuse for a person today. Because today you're a citizen of the world, small world. I mean, no matter where you are, no matter where you live, I mean, you have communication with the rest of the world. So, and everybody knows that you just get a computer set up or whatever. I mean, maybe you can go to a library, get a book. I mean, if a person is genuinely seeking the truth, then it's very difficult for me, you know, to imagine that he didn't have any chance. He doesn't have any choice. If he wants to use his mind, the information is available. And the teachers are available. So the time of Avraham Avinu was not. He relied completely. That's what the Rambam is telling you, is that he relied completely on his own mind and nothing else. No help whatsoever. And of course you see from that, again, it's no gauge of what we're saying, that ultimately a person has the right to rely on his own mind and to base his life on the decisions that he's arrived at through the proper use of his own mind. So this is like this. Well, Ben Avram Shana, Hikir Avram is Boro. Avram was 40 years old when he recognized his creator. He recognized until that time he was religious. He used to worship idolatry. But that's meaningless. The whole point of our existence is to gain a recognition of our Creator. Now, how many people have that? I mean, does one achieve that merely by conforming to Orthodox Judaism? Being an Orthodox Jew, you automatically recognize your Creator? Is it so pashut? Well, I'll leave that as a question. Now, what did he do next? The religious person can be very complacent and secure, and indeed is not searching. But the whole essence of life is Hashem Shemayim Hishkif al Bnei Adam Leros Hayesh Maskil Doresh Shalakim, to be searching for God. So you can't be complacent. You always have to be searching for God. You have to be in a state where you're searching for God. It's an endless search. The person is not searching for God. He's just stagnating. It's a defect, I'm saying, in his religious existence. According to Ayah, that envisions religion. I'm using that word, you know. Okay, equivocally. Now, what did he do? Kivon shehikir v'yada. As soon as he recognized and knew, he had knowledge. So, of course, the state, the proper state, is a state of knowledge. Hischil lahoshiv tshuvos al b'nei ur kasim. He began to write tshuvos. Tshuvos, it would be refutation. He began to formulate refutation. Okay, that would be a good translation. To formulate refutations for the people of ur kasim. A. V'laro din imohem. And to set up debates, din is like a judgment, to have a confrontation, an intellectual confrontation with them. V'lomar she'ein zu derech ha'emes. If this is not the true way, she'atem holchem bo. You're not going in the true, in the path of truth. Okay? V'shibar hatzlonim, and he broke the idol. That's the famous story you all learned about when you were kids. He broke the ice, smashed the idols. And he began to make known to the nation, Shein Roy Lavo, that it is not fitting to worship Ella Lelokaya Olam, the God of the world. So they were worshiping, they were religious people. They were very religious people, but it's not fitting to do what you're doing, except to worship to the God of the world, of the universe. Below Roy Lishdachavos, and unto him it is fitting to bow, Ulahakriv, and to bring sacrifices, Wanasech, and to pour libation. Today, Sheyakiruhu Kalabruim Habayim. In order that, now the Kedai is not clear what it goes back on. What's the Kedai modifying? That all of the Beruim, all the created beings, should recognize them. All those who are Habayim, all future generations. In order that all future generations, what is that for? An all future generations. All right, let's just analyze that little ketah that we just did. Okay, you got it? What are the steps? Step one is that as soon as he recognized the Creator and he knew, he began to tshuvos, to formulate tshuvos, and to have a debate. Okay? And to say that this is not the true path. Then he broke the idol. Then the hischil odia, seems to be repetitive. Then it says after he broke the idol, the hischil odia la'am she'en roi lavod ela lo ka'olam, seems to be repetitive because that seems to have occurred before he broke the idol. Okay? So you have three steps over here. After he recognized the truth, three steps. Tshuvos and debate, breaking of the idols, and then he began to... Actually, there's four. Then he began to tell the people that it's not fitting to accept and serve the God of the universe. And unto him, the fourth step would be that it is fitting to sacrifice. Ulanaseh, and so forth. Kadeshi Yakiruhu. In order that all the future people should recognize him. Which we don't know what does that fit in? In order to the future generation recognize him is modifying what? You understand? Where does that come in? Okay, so what are the questions? Let's hear the question. He said he's engaged in two different types of activities that seem to be contradictory. One is intellectual, and the other one is like
emotional damage.
Physical, violence. I mean, what was his intention? I mean, if the objective, if breaking the idols is the proper way to go, okay? So then why bother with the debate and what's the whole point of that? Just break the idol. I assume that by breaking the idol, what's the objective of breaking the idol? So therefore, if he can break it, so he's proving to them that they have no power, obviously. I assume. So that's a knockout punch, that he could destroy their idol. Well, if that's the case, then what do you have to have a debate with them first? Just not just destroy the idol. In other words, you go around destroying our idol, idolatry. say, that's the question, if you have to use an intellectual approach, or use an intellectual approach, then what's the purpose of destroying the idols? I mean, it's like inconsistent, and it also may show a little bit of a weakness here, like, why are you breaking the idols? Why not just rely on the proof of your ideas, the strength of your ideas? It's really important of this, and that is that you should not overestimate yourself. An intelligent person, even if he has correct ideas, should know the vulnerability points in the human psyche. Man is extremely vulnerable on the emotional level to certain images. In other words, it's not by accident that every idolatrous system in the world has statues. It's not by accident. It's not just a symbol, like, okay, I don't believe it. You know, like, you have a picture of someone who's your hero, your sports hero. Then O.J. Simpson, okay? Then you see what a... he was your sports hero. Then so you have his picture over the wall. Then you discover what he truly is, and then you go home and you just drew up the picture. See? Now, if that is the case, then I don't think Avraham would have had to be Meshavah the Plum. A statue has a certain fascination. It's more... You see, it's not just a symbol of something to remind you of something, but it actually has an effect upon you. And even a person with the correct ideas will be affected on the emotional level. You see, by the way, that's why you see, and you should not overestimate yourself. That's why it's so important. People don't understand this. Why it's usher, you know, to have any type of association, to listen to the music, to go inside a church, and to admire just for the architecture and the art and so on and so forth. These things, that's one thing. You see? That's by association. But the idol itself has a very powerful hold upon a person. People invest like the Statue of Liberty. It has a, when you do see it, it's like, well, you go to the parks in New York, there's like these statues of people on horses or whatever, you know, like, it does have an impact on the human psyche. And the psychological reaction that it produces. And that's why these are stumbling blocks. That's why they're stumbling blocks. I mean, it's interesting, you see that when we came into the Varam, that you have to destroy, you have to uproot them, destroy them. They have to be destroyed. Why do they have to be destroyed? Because they evoke a very powerful emotion, and when they evoke that emotion, so then a person is really in a state of conflict, even if he has the correct ideas intellectually. Avraham Avinu realized was that the cure for idolatry would have to be intellectual. That's why tshuvos means he broke them down. Now, once he discovered that, I would say like this, it was not that Avraham Avinu was in any type of a doubt, and therefore he had to win other people over to his ideas. Because it says, Hikir V'yada. He knew the truth. He was completely confident of of his own ideas, because he knew that they were true. And he knew that the entire world was in error. He knew that. If you go back a sentence, when he discovered, it says, when V'yada Sheyesham Elokai Echad, he knew that there was one God, and he's the cause of all the movements of the spheres, and he created everything, and there is nothing in all of existence, there's no other God than him, there's no other power besides him. The Yadasha kol ha'olam tov, and he knew that the entire world was there. So that was before he began. It's not that he had to convince himself that everybody was mistaken, because once you know the truth, there's no doubt in your mind that this is the truth. So therefore, if the entire world believes something else, then you know that they're all mistaken. That's not a problem, by the way. You wouldn't have that problem in any other area. You wouldn't have that problem in any other area. I mean, if you knew, you were in a society where people had a crazy idea of an airplane, what caused them to fly, these little spirits, you know, with wings, you know, and you know what an airplane is, and you know the engine, etc., So you know that they're all, well, you discovered this. You're part of that society. And everybody believes that airplanes fly because of these, you know, angelic beings that hover under, on top of them, underneath them, etc. And you make the inquiries and, you know, all that, discoveries, you take it apart, and you discover the principles of physics that are responsible. So you know exactly why it flies. So are you going to be any doubtful? One second, the rest of the world thinks, hey, you've discovered. If you've unraveled the false idea, you see that it's false, and you see what the truth is. Then the fact that the entire world has that same false idea is not going to matter to you whatsoever. You're going to know, your knowledge of the truth will bring with it the knowledge that the entire world is in error. And I don't think it would bother you one iota. Yes, I was saying before, it's true too. Every scientist is departing from the knowledge of the time. And he's making a discovery which is contrary to what others believe. Now, therefore, when Avram engaged the people, it was not because he was unsure. He knew that they were in error. So really, he was doing it for a different reason. He was doing it because he recognized that he had an obligation to do so. That it was the will of the Creator. That's exactly what the purpose of human existence was. To form a correct notion of God. Now, he knew that the method that he would have to use would have to be intellectual. If he would just have gone around and destroyed every idol, they would have replaced it with other idols. You see? The attachment to idolatry would not have been uprooted. So now the question is, what was his methodology? I think it's extremely important to understand that. What was his methodology? To begin with, it has to be intellectual. And chuvos means breakdown, questions, contradictions. Why are you doing this? See, sort of a Socratic kind of thing. That's what the chuvos, to show them v'lar al din, and debate. See, here, in the first phase, he was not telling him what the truth is. He wasn't telling them what they should be doing. He was simply analyzing what they were doing. And to show them that it was totally false, that it didn't make any sense, that it could not be intellectually defended. Okay? Alright. But you have to understand one thing, that idolatry is really, is it an emotional thing or is it an intellectual thing? If it's an intellectual thing, so then he could have stopped at this point. So what is it then? We have to ask ourselves that question. What was he had to ask himself, what was he confronting? Was he confronting an intellectual phenomenon? False ideas? Or was he confronting certain emotional phenomena? I was like this. That if you ask, religious people are very fanatic. Very, very fanatic. I mean, actually, you know, they kill. The biggest cause of war is religious. I mean, these Hamas terrorists, the most cruel, aggressive people are religious people. Probably the biggest cause of cruelty in history and destruction is in religion. False ideas bring out a tremendous amount of aggression in people. False ideas are very dangerous. Now, the religious person is attached to his religion for emotional reasons, but in his own mind, it's truth, it's absolute truth. You see, he cannot indulge the emotion. That is the entire essence of the emotion. The essence of the emotion is to believe that this is, that his, you see, his system is actually corresponds to reality. That's why the leader of, I mean, you'll have these, you'll say, you know, you can't have an argument, a religious argument, it's impossible, because the person won't yield, he won't budge. You see? So therefore, it's essential for the person to believe that his religious system is the truth. So now, if you ask him, why do you follow the system? He's not going to say, because I feel that way. He's going to say, because it's the truth. How do you know it's the truth? Well, then he'll bring in because I feel so powerfully, whatever nonsensical way he has. But it's essentially he's got to be able to maintain in his own mind that it's true. So that's, therefore you have to break down that fiction to him that it's true, that it's not tenable anymore. And there you have to use your seichel, you have to draw him into an argument by asking questions. You can't launch an attack. You can't start off by saying, your way is false. There's no way to do that. You see, Avram didn't do that. But he began to formulate tshuvos, little questions. You know, why are you doing such and such? And, but doesn't that contradict what he's doing? And doesn't that, you see, to show the, to start breaking down slowly but surely the concept that it's true. Until he really was able to succeed. Yeah. But what about the emotion? The emotional attachment. That he realized that that's not enough. To simply show them in their own mind that this is a weak system, that it's false. He had to do something to break the emotional attachment. And there's nothing. You reach a certain point in working with the mind where you really then you have to attack the emotion. And the attack on the emotion was to destroy the idols. Now they were ready for it. See, now they were ready for it. But without destroying the idols. I'm telling you, there's an inherent attachment to the idol itself. The emotion will exist as long as the idol is there. The idol creates the emotion. And it maintains the emotion. And the only way it can be broken, I remember years ago there was a student here, he was a very bright guy. I mean, he knew, you know, he learned a good deal about the philosophy and so forth, and I just noticed that he was doing something which was a knock on wood, that type of thing. He said something. I couldn't believe it. You know, that's a superstitious thing. You know, people knock on wood. You heard that one, right? What? Oh, well, I don't know. I'm not sure if that's the one. Honestly, I'm not sure if that's the one. Maybe there's another. Some type of superstition. I'm not sure. And he said that he knows it's crazy. He says he knows it's crazy. But he just can't control it. It's like a compulsive kind of thing. So,
like unconscious,
a person that says that says he knows it is stupid, but he can't help but doing it. Obviously, this reflects a certain emotional weakness. He cannot be perfected because he's not being controlled by extraneous forces. It means that there's a part of him which is fearful that if he doesn't do this, something bad will happen to him. But this is not in life. He's in a state of confidence. His mind tells him this is crazy. Yeah, but there's a certain very powerful emotional conviction. Now, there, the solution is you've got to force the guy. When it happens, you've got to hold the guy down, not let him do it. Because that behavior of it. At that point, you see, when the emotion can't be satisfied, and he actually goes through the experience, right, of seeing that nothing will happen to him, then his mind, and his mind, see, this is the mind. Now that which the mind knows will be in line with the emotions, and he'll be cured. That's why the Rambam, the Avraham Avinu's methodology was to cure the person. The first way to cure the person is by showing him that the defenses that he's established, the intellectual defenses to justify his system, are totally false. But then he still has the emotional attachment. He has the fear, and the only way to do so is by actually destroying it. Then you see, then he becomes whole again. Then he sees that this is just wood and stone, and it's no different than the wood that he see. He's reversing the process. You see. And that's the way he operates. The Shiva has flown. But that's essential. What's the vehiskel hodilam? She'ein roi lavod ela lelo kaha olam. That's step number three. Yeah. In other words, first, you see, and this is the derech of the Torah, that first a person has to be free, has to be liberated from his idolatrous ideas. That he has to retire himself by cleansing himself from his idolatrous notions. And that's intellectual and that's emotional. Then, of course, then the person's in limbo. So what am I supposed to do? Alright, so I won't be religious. There is a religion. There is a religion. But all the religious activity of man has to be directed to Elohim, to the true God. If it's not to the true God, then it's destructive. Okay? If it's not, now these people were all religious people, extremely religious people. And he was telling them that essentially it's worthless. It has to be directed to Elohim Olam. Then he said like this, V'lo roi l'shtachavos. And to him it's fitting to bow down, Ula hakriv, Ula naseach. Ula naseach. See, he even goes further than that, and he does say that it's fitting to have religious ceremonies. He did not demand of them that they abandon, because that's another. Why get involved already? Once you start sacrificing, see, that's a borderline. According to the Rambam, that's a dangerous kind of thing, because once you're involved in sacrificing, that's already leading you can lead you astray, that whole system. But apparently, he maintained that it's an impossibility, that people have to have a means of gratifying their religious emotional needs. But that's permitted, provided that it's directed purely to God. That's sort of like a dangerous, like a boundary line, the borderline over here. The twilight zone. The twilight zone. But listen, what is it like this? Kadeshiyak Yiru Kalabum Avayim. And all that, nobody answered that. What is that? Where does that today go back to? Okay, I just want to mention before he goes on, one more thing. This is very important. Baroi la abe du l'shabe kalaturos. Then he started saying, you must break all the images, all the form units. I thought he broke them already. I mean, what is he saying? Baroi la abe du l'shabe kalaturos. Now he's teaching that you have to go around, you must destroy every one of these turos. I assume it's after he's already destroyed some of them anyways, and already he's cured them. I think it fits into the point I made before. That you cannot tell, why? Because there will always be a Kadesh Lo Yitubehen Kalam. That these images, these statues, have a certain intrinsic power. I don't mean that they have any power. I'm saying in the human psyche. The human psyche is such that it's as I said, it is not accidental. It's not accidental that people make statues. It is ingrained. If you understand the workings of the human psyche, then you'll understand why the idolatrous mentality will always create statues. And statues have a tremendous effect. As long as they exist, they're a stumbling block, even to people with correct ideas. Because you see, there are very powerful emotions. And people can have correct ideas, and yet their emotions are not... If those emotions are going to be... It's like a magnet. It's going to attract those emotions to the idol. Then it's going to create a... In the unconscious, the person will not be complete with God. That's the... That's why Yahadis demands the destruction of idolatry in the land. Because that will always be a stumbling block. And that's, by the way, if you take a look at the story of in Shoftim, that's the whole tragedy of Shoftim, that they failed to uproot idolatry from the land. And it remained as a stumbling block, and eventually the Jews succumbed to Avodah Zarah, and that was the... that's basically the whole history of the Bayis Rishon, the battle with idolatry. There's truth. However, you could break it down. I think the Rambam introduced Kadesh Yak Yiru with regard to the last element, when he advised them to sacrifice and to have a system of worship to the God of the universe. Because that's, I assume that's a big chiddush, because the concept that they had of God is one which lends itself to religion. It's made for religion because it's statues, it's duplicate statues, it's physical, it's forces, you know, it's something which man, it's a man-made system, so it's something that man can relate to. But now that we're telling you that all this is false, that there's no such thing, there are no beings, these demons are just things that you've created, these powers that you're... But there is a being beyond the universe, and it's essentially unknowable. Okay, so that knocks out... Now, the answer is that there is a mess, there is. You can have a religion, you can have a religion which is founded on this true idea, as astounding as that sounds. And that, I think, is Kadesh Yak Yiru. The first thing that he did was something else. In other words, that was for the people of his time. For the people of his time, you see people that are lost in confusion and corruption and so forth, so you have an obligation to try and help them, to try and teach them. That's one thing. For that, it would have been sufficient to teach them to break the Talmud and so forth, to give them a correct notion of God. That's it. Now you have a correct notion of God. What do you have to have sacrifices? But I think that Avraham was concerned for the future as well. That's clear. He was concerned for the future as well. In order for the future as well, you have to institute correct systems, because the next generation is going to... Another year, just like you will corrupt because a false system was established, and once it's established, you can't get rid of it. It just goes on and on and on. And every generation is born into the false system, and basically they're lost. So your obligation now is to cleanse yourself, to remove the false, and to establish a true system, so that the next generation will inherit a true system. That's why he says, going along with that, then you got to destroy idolatry. If that's the case, then you have to uproot idolatry. You have to uproot idolatry. Every form of idolatry has to be uprooted. And interestingly enough, let's just say one more point. You'll find this interesting. Kivan Shev, what happens next? So what happens with Avram's experiment in trying to tamper with people's religious emotions? Okay. Kivan Shev Gavar Alein Bira Yosav. Once he began to overpower them with his proofs, his mighty intellectual proofs, he was devastating them. He was winning the battle. Bikesh Hamelech Lahargo. The king thought to kill him. Venasal Anais, and Anais, he doesn't mention the particular, you know, that he was put into the furnace, he just says it was Derech Hashgacha. Now, according to the natural laws, he would have been killed. The Yasla Charon, he went to Charon. The question is why, though? I was trying to understand why the king seek to kill him. It's an interesting idea right there. I think that there's an inherent connection between the political and the at least in ancient religion plays a vital role. Religion, who refers to it as the opium of the masses? I mean, religion keeps the people under control. False religion keeps it, especially in history in those days, it was essential. The king, because the king, I'll tell you why, he's not operating in a system of justice. In a system of political injustice, right? So you need something which keeps the people under control, right? And prevents them from rebelling. And that is the deadening of the mind, the destruction of the mind, which religion is beautiful at accomplishing. Now, I think the great danger posed by Avram was that he got people to really question the most fundamental things. In other words, every society, if you assume that people live according to the system that they've inherited, and they don't question it. So in religion, that's the most powerful. But then in the political structure, the king, no one questions these things. Just people take it for granted. Even today, I mean, people take them for granted. That's the way it has to be. There's no question. Can't even think about that. Can't even question it. Now, the two are interconnected at some point. But what Avram was doing was truly revolutionary. In a different level, he was opening up the human mind. He was opening up the human mind, which was completely closed. Therefore, it resulted in the defeat, or at least was looked that way. I mean, he was on the road to victory in terms of defeating false religion, which is the most powerful emotion of all. Well, it would only be a matter of time until they began to quit with that methodology that he was teaching them. So why should the political system be the way? Obviously, it was not a system of freedom, it was a system of oppression. See? So the king realized that he couldn't tolerate this type of a phenomenon. Any unjust ruler must suppress people's freedom, must suppress people's must be in contradiction to people's true interests in terms of fulfilling their purpose. Any unjust leader. And that's why in a similar way, when Socrates began to question foundations of the system. I don't know if it's the particularity as much as the fact that you're opening up the human mind. Contrarily, it says that we read it, V'atam tili mamlachas kohanim v'gai kadosh. What does Rashi say on kohanim, mamlachas kohanim? Sarim. Asar. Meaning, the only free people, a governed people that's free, is the people that are living in accordance with the rational system, with Yadav. That's mamlachas kohanim. But that's only possible in Yadav, because the objective of Yadav is to lead man to the true ideas. So then you're a free person. Each person is a free person. Nobody's a slave. There are no slaves over here. Because whatever a person is doing, he's doing it for his own best. It's the system which combines that which is good for the body politic, at the same time as perfecting the individual. See? There's no sacrifice. But in every other system, your freedom is extremely limited, and essentially, by and large, you're just a tool for the governing... You're just a cog in the big machine of the state. Avram is not conducive. He would not have been a very popular figure in communist Russia, right? I don't think so. I think he would have not been welcome there. There's really no choice. I mean, the question about why would a person give up his life rather than be over to Hazara? I mean, on a purely logical level, there's absolutely no choice. Because you're saying for what? I mean, if you refuse, so you'll lose physical existence, but your soul is intact. You have a true life. On the other hand, if you agree, then you don't have anything. So then you lose your soul. So then you just you've given up your soul, so you just have physical existence. Give it up. But you're not going to have what you have right now. Right now you're addressing it to someone who is not worshipped idols. You're addressing it to someone who believes in God. So you're addressing it to someone who's living his life as a human being. But if you worship idols, then you're not a human being anymore. Now you become a behemoth. So you're not even going to have physical existence. He told me, I'll let you live, but you have to give your mind. It's like saying, you do such and such, or I'll kill you, or else, right? Or if you do it, I'll let you live. But by doing it, you're going to give up your mind. You're going to lose your mind. You'll no longer be able to think clearly. Would you take that? My maintaining is that the choice, worship idols or die, is not even a choice for any person who's rational. There's no choice. He has no choice. Because what are you giving me in return? Even according to your terms, what are you giving me? You're giving me life? You're not giving me life. Because once I do that, I don't have life anymore.
What are you living
for? Because
of
Allah? No, because my whole soul is distorted. I don't have a soul anymore.
You can go through the motions.
I'm saying you can't go through the motions. When the Torah prohibited Avodah Zarah, as I just showed you, you can't go through the motions because these emotions, are so powerful that the very act of being an idolater will have a negative impact upon you. It will destroy your soul. So you can't just go through the motions. Okay? Now, the question, of course, is with regard to Avraham Avinu, why did he rock the boat? That's the question that Jovi's posing. What was his obligation to rock the boat? Isn't that what you're saying? Why do you rock the boat? Why don't you just stay home and be safe? Just to be in all fairness, one can ask, when Avram embarked on it, when he began, did he know at the time that he was heading towards destruction? It's not clear that he did. It seems to be that once he arrived at the truth, he realized that he had an obligation to make it known to others. I don't know that he knew at that time all the effects that this would have and that eventually he'd be putting himself in jeopardy by doing that. There's no indication that he did so with the knowledge that he'd be jeopardizing himself. However, you have to ask the question, let's assume that he would have had that knowledge. The question is still a good question, it's just that it may not apply to the actual history of Avraham. Okay? Yeah. But the question itself, how far are we obligated to go? Are we obligated to place our lives, if Avraham did know, if he was warned, listen Avraham, stuff is okay, it's nice, just keep it to yourself. Because you're going to get killed. It's hard to go to the other extreme also. Yeah, it's hard to go to the other extreme and say that Avram, with that type of understanding of human nature and knowledge, what he knew, he may not have known that he'd be actually requiring a miracle, because I guess any sum's all in eight, but I guess he would have known that it's not the safest thing in the world. He's probably better off, from a practical standpoint, to keep it to himself. Okay? But let's assume, for the purpose of the question, that he would have known that there's a danger, what would he have done then? Just to say or not, I mean, unless they're worshipped, they're not.
Statues,
it has to be dimensional.
Three-dimensional.
Three-dimensional, it has a certain effect upon the psyche. I tell you the truth, if you ask the question right, it's a good question, you don't have to go. You can ask this question, could Avraham Avinu, was this something volunteer work, even if it didn't entail a risk, but he's still giving up his life for the cause. Even if he didn't, he's not dying for the cause, but he's still spending his whole life. He could have done other things. Was this something, was this voluntary, over and above the requirements? Oh, yeah. Could he have just as well retired at that point? And not engaged, if he was. Yeah, why did he, what motivated him? So we said what motivated, but is that you have to do that, or is it simply he wants to do that? Is that something which he's obligated to do? Or is that something which he wanted to do? Okay, that's the first question. Then, after that, you can say, well, one second, what if it's a risk to his life? But first you have to establish, what exactly is the nature of the compulsion here, the compelling factor? Is it obligatory or is it voluntary? Sorry.
With regard to the story of the destruction of Sodom and Amorah, and of course, the fact that Lot was saved, and also it gives you the whole story about how he took care of the guests. He thought, the angels, but he thought that they were ordinary people, and he made a party for them, right? certain subtleties in the psukim that you have to pick up on. If you, the description of how Lot took care of the guest is pretty similar to the description of how Avram took care of the guest. Pretty similar. Not everything is identical, but they're pretty similar. It says that Avram pleaded with them, please not pass by his house, and offered them some water and wash your feet and rest under the tree, and then he offered them bread. Of course, then he went to Vayamayar. He hurried and he got Sarah to prepare these cakes, and then he went to get he gave more than he had mentioned, obviously, and he prepared the meat, a fine calf, and then chema v'chalav, then butter and milk and so forth, and v'hu omed aleim, and he stood over them. In other words, almost like a waiter, you know, to make sure that everything was fine. So he treated them very, very nicely, obviously. All right, so then you see later on they come to Lot, and it is relatively similar, because he also he treats them with tremendous hospitality. It says he Lot Yoshe B'Shar Stom Sinyut Tes, and Lot saw them, and he got up and he bowed down to them, and he asked them to please come to his house and to stay lodge overnight and wash your feet, and they refused. So then he really prevailed upon them, and they came to his house. Then it says Vayasla Mishta, and he made a party for them, umatos afa vayochelu, and he baked matos and they ate. So, all right, it doesn't mention that he made Magavram made them more chema v'chalav and so forth, but other than the specifics of the food, is there anything that catches your attention over here? Yeah, it says Vayas Lahem Mishta. And Mishta is
Sporna
says Yayin?
Yeah.
Yayin. Kfi Yisud Ala Yayin, he says. That's Mishta. Alright. And there he mentions Bios. I will leave the rest of that statement for, because it don't read the rest of this for now at this point. Okay. Yeah, Maz is a Pesachai. That's another interesting idea. One thing at a time. What inference would you draw? Was there any essential difference between the mitzvah of Achlas Zorchim as practiced by Avram and as practiced by Lot? Are these psukim simply giving us details? All right, he served these foods, he served those foods, and so forth. Or it's more than just details, but it indicates a difference in the whole approach. Something big in the opinion. The key difference is Mishta. I agree with Johnny on that. That the key difference is Mishta. By Avram, you don't have the Mishta. There's no Mishta. And I think that indicates something. But what it indicates, we have to be reasonable over here. The fact that he offered them to sleep over doesn't indicate a greater degree of generosity. Simply, that was the factual situation. It was earlier in the day, yeah. It was earlier in the day, and it was clear they were traveling, so it made no sense. At that point in time, it made sense to just offer them refreshment. Here, it was night, and they said they'll sleep in the rechov. They'll sleep in the streets, basically. And he invited them to his house, so that made sense. That showed that Lot didn't just give them food, but he brought them into his home, which is very nice. To bring strangers into your home, That's the high degree of chesed, the high degree of hospitality. The key is, in my opinion, the key difference is on Mishta. I think there's a significance as far as that's concerned. And I tend to agree with Johnny. I'll tell you what my interpretation is. All right? Then you can agree or disagree.
In my opinion, see, Mishta is a party. The Torah is interesting. Usually, the Torah included the word for a reason. Now, it seems to me that a person can practice Hachnasas Orcham can be based upon two sources. There's a difference in the practice of Hachnasas Orcham of Avraham. And it seems to me, who omed Alehem means that Avraham was not involved in satisfying the social instinct. Certain emotions for people to socialize. They enjoy socializing. So, now, of course, there's nothing wrong with the emotion. A person can utilize that emotion, if he has the proper philosophy of life, to direct that emotion towards the good. He can help people, he gets involved with helping people. Now, it's true, when he's doing it, and he's involved in the activity and it's a mitzvah. But underneath it all, there's a certain emotion that's in line with that mitzvah. So he's deriving emotional satisfaction. Lots of times people... a person can practice Hachnasas Orchem as his house is always open, but could be that it's a mitzvah, no one's taking away from it, but part of his personality is he really enjoys people, he likes people, he likes to socialize and so forth, so then he's always involved in this kind of an activity, which is nothing wrong with that. A person should utilize all of his energies. A person should know his own emotions, and instead of wasting his time going to useless parties and hanging out, he could take that same emotion and gratify it in the framework of a mitzvah. So what's wrong with that? Now, in the case of Avraham, it seems to me that the chesed that he practiced was not based upon that emotional need to socialize. Because he was totally involved in Avraham Hashem. You see, the whole story occurs when he's involved in according to one pshat, he was involved in a nevuah. And he asks God to please wait, so to speak, and allow him to excuse himself to practice the mitzvah of Hachnas Zorchem. So what does Chazal say over there? That Gadol Hachnas Zorchem, that Hachnas Zorchem is greater than Akbalas Bnei Shechina, than being in communion with the Shechina. Which means to say that this mitzvah, when properly performed, the mitzvah of V'yach L'Reicha, so to speak, the mitzvah of extending kindness to a fellow human being, it partakes of in a certain way of directing one's energy to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's based upon one's Ahavas Hashem. So for Avraham, it was clearly related to his Ahavas Hashem. In other words, it wasn't something he engaged in order to derive personal emotional satisfaction. The satisfaction was purely because of the energy that was tied up in Ahavas Hashem. And you see it in Hu Omed Aleihem. He did all these various activities, right? It was all an expression of his Ahavas Hashem, as it's manifested in Ahavas Abrios. But the true Avas Abrios is really comes from a Avas Hashem. In the case of Lot, I'm not criticizing. I'm not saying that it wasn't a mitzvah. Clearly, it was a very, very big mitzvah of Achnas Zarchem. In fact, you see the extent that he went to protect them. And clearly, the purpose behind the story is to give us a reason for understanding why he was saved, why he warranted being saved, even though he lived amongst these Rishayim, but still, he had not been corrupted. The basic corruption was that they had no compassion, no sense of compassion for anyone who was a stranger, for an outsider. And he was completely different because he had saved himself from that corruption. However, Mishteh to me indicates a certain it was connected to a certain social emotion he enjoyed. Not that I wouldn't say it was just an excuse to have a party. It's hard to say that because you see he went out of his way. I don't think. Was that he endangered himself? So you have to take everything in context. To say that this wasn't an act of tzidkus, that it wasn't a mitzvah, just because of mishteh, I don't want to go that far. Because you see, in my opinion, it was genuine hachnasas orchem. It's a high level. But that one, see, if the emotion is there, it's waiting for an opportunity to express itself. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with this. I'm just trying to show you. Yeah, that the difference was that once he had them and they came, he didn't invite them to a mishteh. He didn't say, come, we'll have a party. No, he was truly involved. I would say that not when he spotted them, he said, oh, I could have a party. I don't think that was the motivating factor. He was on a high level and he really believed in the importance of Achnas Zorchem, so he prevailed upon them. However, once the situation was established and they came to his house and there were people there, so then the emotion of a mishter, was a certain emotional enjoyment of having a mishter, that came to the fore. So you see, that's a difference between the Achnas Zorchim of Lot and that of Avram, which means it's a lower level. It's a lower level because it needed that emotional support within his personality. Whereas with Avram, it wasn't based on any emotion of sociability, that he wanted to socialize with people. It was purely rooted in his Ahavas Hashem. So it's that one word indicates a significant difference in the in the two. Let's take up the idea of Matos Ocha Vayochelu. So there's a Rashi over here. Right, what does Rashi say? Pesach Chayim. Rashi says it was Pesach. Now, what are the problems with that? There are many problems with that. First of all, as far as my understanding is that this is pre-Matan Torah, and Pesach comes into being at after Matan Torah. Some of the commentaries, if you take it literally, then the question is, if that's the case, then what about Avraham? So either you're going to say that was Erev Pesach, but it has to be even an Erev Pesach. But they say that. So some want to say that Ugos is Matashira, that type of thing. No, I don't. My point is not to argue with those who want to take it literally. That's not my point. I just want to show another way of understanding it, which avoids the need to take it literally. And but I'm not knocking any of the other children. That's not my purpose. I'd love to state the problem, because obviously it's pre-Matan Torah. And okay, so it's brought down in different places that the others kept the Tariag Mitzvahs. Okay, but even that, then the question arises, what does that mean? Does that mean literally? Because, for example, a mitzvah like this, how did they keep a mitzvah which was based upon historical circumstance? Because the eating of matzah, it's one thing to say a mitzvah which is applicable at all times. A mitzvah of Shabbos or Shatnez or whatever the case. It's not based on any particular event. It reflects the concept of perfection. But those mitzvahs which have to do with Zeichel, Tzias, Mitzrayim essentially are a Zeicher of a specific event, and that event didn't happen. So where's the mitzvah? How could they do the mitzvah? Were they eating matzah to commemorate what? The future? You see, it just doesn't make sense. It's very difficult to understand, let's put it that way. So, I don't know the reason behind it. I'm not saying, therefore, that you have to reject it, but you can also, you're not obligated, therefore, to say that Chazal meant that they kept it literally. You could say that the mitzvos, when they kept the mitzvos, it means that they knew every mitzvah is based upon a certain idea of perfection. It contains within a certain concept of perfection. So in that sense, keeping of the mitzvos doesn't have to mean literally that they kept all of Taryag. Is that going to be impossible to take a little? They didn't build the base of Migdash. I mean, they didn't wipe out Amalek. I mean, it's going to be very, very difficult to, under any situation, to say they kept all 613. But my understanding is that the underlying philosophy, the basic perfection, every mitzvah has an element of perfection, and that was known to them, the perfection of the entire system they knew, and then they kept. What specifically they kept in terms of real mitzvahs, I don't know. Now the problem would be like this, though. There's another problem somebody just mentioned, Moshe just mentioned, because even if you're going to say literally that they kept Tayag the others, but here we're talking about Lot. And Lot is not one of the Avos. So even if you're going to say that the Avos did keep Tariag, you're going to say it means literally, however strange it may seem. that the sukkah, they built the sukkah and they kept the lulav and all, everything. Even if they say that, but why about lot? How does that make sense in terms of lot? So look at the Rambam. The Rambam, I believe it's in Malachim. He talks about the Shemesh of Zainach. Then he says that Avram came and he was Moses Milo. Right? And Tefillah in the morning. And then Yitzchak was most of this and he was most of that. It would seem that there was a certain type of a development until it was completed. Actually, initial one. Until the Torah system of mitzvahs was completed later on at Sinai. So if Avram kept all the mitzvahs, what are we talking about over here?
But even if they did keep it, whether they did or not.
One of the ideas you're familiar with. You heard my share on Pesach Mitzrayim. I give a whole share on Pesach Mitzrayim, given it a number of times, this tape's on. Focusing around the issue as to why the Jews were given that mitzvah in Mitzrayim. What's the purpose behind it? And so Rashi, I did the Rashi's over there. Rashi says that everything was, the time had come, which was destined for them to be saved, but they didn't have mitzvahs. They needed mitzvahs in order to warrant being saved. And the second reason he gives is because they were shtufim be'alilim. Apparently, we all know that the Jews had become corrupted in Mitzrayim in terms of idolatry. They were steeped in idolatry, and therefore this was a mitzvah. The God was saying, Mishchu k'chu, pull away from the idol and take a seshal mitzvah. So the objective was to see whether the Jews were capable of removing themselves from total involvement in the idolatrous and to redirect their energy towards a seshal mitzvah, to do a maisa a mitzvah. Okay? So basically the if you go to the Rambam, take a look at the Rambam in Hilchos Avodah Chachamim. So the first chapter over there, he's like in a little bit of history, right? Gives you the whole history of mankind that originally had the correct notion of God. And then how the corruption of idolatry set into the world through Enosh, the mistake of Enosh. They made an intellectual mistake pertaining to how what God's will was, that it was God's will that people should worship those beings that were superior beings and so forth, and this was really a worship of God. You know, they had the true idea of God, so forth. But it was a corruption already, because it had elements of projection. And then once that corruption was established, it kept going more further and further and further until they lost the idea of God altogether, and they just bowed down to objects, and they believed that these objects had power. And he said even the wise amongst them didn't think it was the idol itself, but there were forces behind the idol. But no one in the world at all knew about the existence of God until Avraham Avinu came along, and he was raised in that society. And he worshipped, but he started to question, and he went through a lengthy process until he discovered the truth, and he extricated himself from the false ideas. And in fact, it took the Chazal say that he started when he was 3 years old. He started on this process. The Rambam says he was 40 years old when he came to that firm conclusion. So Rav Chaim one time explained why it took so many years to make the discovery. Because he said he was working on two different fronts. Because he himself, since he was raised in that society, he was affected by all the emotions. And so he was involved in intellectual pursuit, the abstract truth. That's one thing. But then he also had to extricate himself emotionally from all of those very powerful phenomena. And then when he was 40 years old, then he began to have debates with them and to break down their false ideas. Then it says he broke down the idols. Then he taught them about the true idea of God, that there's only one being who is the source of all existence, and to him alone is it fitting to worship. Now, it seems that when Avram had an effect upon Lot as well. Lot also accepted the basic idea. Lot also separated itself. Because when Of course, eventually Avram got into trouble with the king. The Rambam points out the king wanted to kill him, and God saved him. And then God told him to leave completely, Lech Lecha. And Vayelech, he told Lot, and Lot went with him. So therefore, we must assume, in my opinion, that of course that Lot had the same. Lot wasn't an idol worshiper. Lot accepted the philosophy of Avram. And they traveled together. All right, at one point in time, they separated. It's a different issue. They separated. Rashi says the issue was the shepherds had a fight and pertained together. You know, where you can allow your sheep to graze and so forth. They had philosophical differences, but it wasn't over the fundamental idea. Now, when the essential idea of Yetzias Mitzrayim, we've gone over this many times, is not simply the physical, that the Jews were saved from the physical oppression, obviously. The real, what was the real Geula? I mean, this Arbal Hashanah Shel Geula. The real Geula was what? Was the spiritual Geula. Yeah, exactly. That they were saved, the spiritual Geula. That they were saved from the false philosophy of Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim was a society which was steeped in idolatry and magic and superstition. And the real Geula was the Geulas HaNefesh, that the Jews had become immersed in a society which was steeped in idolatry, and they themselves had been affected and corrupted by it, and God had related to them and gave them a way of extricating themselves from that corruption. Now, that's what the Achila of Matzah basically represents. Now, I can't go too much into the particular of matzah, but matzah is basically lechem oni. So, again, it's a hypothesis, but it represents the idea of the control over the emotional part of man. In other words, the matzah is the minimal. You can't allow the yeast to rise, because allowing the yeast to rise and everything, that's beyond the physical necessity. That's for the sake of taiva. That's for the sake of giving into one's emotions, so forth. But the lechem oni represents the control over the emotions and the act of eating and so forth. The emotional life of man has to be restrained, and the satisfaction of one's physical needs is a means. But the real objective is to be involved in truth, in the pursuit of truth. So I would say like this: that when the Jews experienced the Yetzias Mitzrayim, this wasn't the first time. This wasn't the first exodus, so to speak, in Jewish history. The first Yetzias Mitzrayim, the ability to go from the state of being immersed in idolatry and to separate yourself and to change and to make that transformation in the self, this was really a repeat of an event. Who was the first individual to experience Yetzias Mitzrayim? Philosophically, Avram. Avram, because that was the same, that the world at that time was steeped in these false ideas, and he was part of that. Of course, he was able to do it as a result of his own greatness, his own study, and so on and so forth. Right? But he separated himself, he extricated himself. And Vayelech Itolot. And later on, the same thing happened to the Jewish people. They found themselves in the same situation. And then God relayed to them, and God gave them a mitzvah, gave them a manner in which they could extricate themselves. So the Zeichel Yetzias Mitzrayim, the eating of matzah, which is Zeichel Yetzias Mitzrayim, is to commemorate that concept of the capacity of a person to extricate himself from total involvement in his primitive emotions. And matzah, in my opinion, is designed to represent that idea. So I am speculating then that this was not a halachic Pesach. And this would answer the question. It means that Lot set aside a time to commemorate the greatest event in his life. The greatest event in his life was when he experienced that freedom. That's the real freedom. The freedom from the false ideas. And everybody in his development, the person has been fortunate enough to discover some essential truth, a true philosophy. He's been searching. And he's been lost. He's living in he's lost, and he's searching. And then finally, he arrives. He finds the teacher or the yeshiva or whatever the situation may be. And he goes through a few months of study, and it changes his mind completely. So he'll always remember back, he always remembers what he was like before, and, you know, what he is like now. He'll commemorate in his mind. In his mind, he remembers the event. Now, in Lot, in the mind of Lot, this was a powerful, powerful phenomenon. He didn't want, and it's necessary not just for the sake of remembering it, but also for the sake of one's perfection. You always have to be on guard not to allow yourself to fall back into that state. So, in my opinion, you can interpret this. This would eliminate the need to say that Lot kept the Taryag. And this was not a halachic phenomenon, that Pesach, that there was a 14th of Nisan and everybody kept Pesach on that day. This would eliminate all the problems of Avraham. You wouldn't be forced, because if we're saying it means that he set aside a time to commemorate that event through the eating of matzah, which is a lechemoni, and that that's fit to represent that idea, so then there's no need, you don't have a problem, because you could say that Avraham also set aside a time, but it didn't have to be the same thing. See, because we're not talking, once the system was given, so then you had a formalized Pesach with a set time. It's got to be formalized, it's got to be objective for everybody, with a set time, with a set practice, and so forth. But I'm saying that Lot was not involved in that kind of a thing over here, but that he simply was he had gone through that experience of extricating himself from the contamination of idolatry, and it makes sense to say that was extremely important to him. You see, he was a high level individual, although he had defects. He was on the level of Abraham, and he wanted to set aside a certain time to remember, because it was that important to him, these ideas. And that's the idea of Pesach. That's the true idea of Pesach. So if you say that, then you can eliminate a lot of the problems. From a philosophical point of view, there's two ideas in Pesach. There's the halachic Pesach, and that halachic Pesach, of course, is based upon a certain historical occurrence, which would have no relevance as far as Lot is concerned. Yeah, but the concept of Pesach, though, is something which did exist before the historical Pesach. The idea of the world being steeped in idolatry and certain individuals being extricated and freed from it, this had occurred before. This occurred in the case of Abraham. And Lot was fortunate, because Lot was not able on his own, he never would have made it. He was fortunate because of his relationship to Abraham. And he was able to learn from Abraham. He was a student of Abraham. So he too had a Yitzias Mitzrayim. The Yitzias Mitzrayim was when they left the bubble, when they left the society that they had come from. They extricated themselves from that society, from that culture. That was truly, philosophically, the first Yitzias Mitzrayim. And when this occurred to the Jews later on, it was really not the first time, it was the second Yitzias Mitzrayim, in terms of the philosophical idea behind it. If you're not going to take it literally, so our methodology was to now go back to Pesach itself. And then remove the question that the question is, but Pesach is just commemorating a historical event which has no relevance. No, but the real Yitzias Mitzrayim. See, I tied it together with the analysis of Pesach Mitzrayim. The real Yitzias Mitzrayim was not a physical phenomenon. The real Yitzias Mitzrayim was the fact that the Jews were saved. The redemption from the false ideas primarily of idolatry. That's Pesach Mitzrayim. Now, once that's the case, the question now exists, does the concept of Yitzias Mitzrayim in that sense have any relevance to Lot? Oh, so the answer is that it does. Because if you go back to the Rambam in Perek Aleph of Hilchos Avos Chacham, you'll see that Avram was in that situation, and Avram extricated himself. Yeah, but the pasuk says Vayelech Ito Lot, that Lot went along with him. So apparently Lot also extricated himself from that situation. And he was not an idolater. It's hard to imagine. Doesn't make any sense. He was a high level. He's worthy of being saved. He was worthy of being saved, so you have to assume that he was a very high level individual. Alright, so it's true. It's true that he did not, it's a question, how could he choose to live amongst immoral people? So that was, alright, that's something else. Fred Chay one time explained the difference between his philosophy and the philosophy of Avraham.
Was that right? Like Malachim came, he thought it was a good opportunity to commemorate.
I don't know, I can't go into why this time. Yeah. Was it coincidental? I don't know why this time. I'm only saying that it's not it's not absurd to say that he set aside a certain time. The key in the pasuk is, I believe, umata zafawa. Why does Rashi have to comment on that at all? It would seem that that would not be the normal. You see, Avram ate cakes. The normal thing would not have been to serve matzos, apparently.
Especially the mishnah.
Otherwise, it doesn't call for any comment. See, by Avram, lushi vasiugos, you know, make cakes and so forth. That doesn't go. That's the way you serve guests. Now, matzos is a little bit sparse, so to speak. So, it calls for a comment, apparently. If this was quite normal, so what does Rashi have to comment on it? What's the point? The pie, apparently, umatos afa, is a little bit of a deviation from the norm. That's not what you'd serve your guests. So therefore, that had to be a reason why he was eating the matzah.
Because right after Mishnah.
Right after Mishnah.
Mishnah and matzah.
So therefore, that had to be a reason. So that's the concept. So the concept, I believe, that Rashi's saying, yeah, the Pesach, it was Pesach. But Pesach doesn't mean Pesach of the world, of the, you know, the night of the 15th of Nisan, necessarily. If you want to take it that way, you can. It's the kind of thing where I'm not saying that this is, you have to take it this way. If you want to say that, if you want to just assume that the laws of Pesach were in effect for everybody, and for Lo too, so you have no problem altogether. It's going to be just, it's also going to be coincidental. You're going to have the same coincidence that the Malachim happened to Kayam on the night of Pesach. I mean, you got the same coincidence. But as I said, I'm trying to offer an explanation in which you don't have to posit these things. It makes sense. The question also, if you assume that they kept all the mitzvos, so why did God have to reveal Mila to him if he was already keeping all the mitzvos and Mila is one of them? Alright. These are difficulties. But as I said, if you don't take it literally, there's nothing wrong with it. I don't think you're not bound to take it literally. And I think this is an explanation.